The Novels of Charles Dickens. An Introduction by David Timson. A Christmas Carol. The idea for A Christmas Carol came to Dickens while he was travelling on a train to Manchester in 1843. The Manchester Athenaeum provided education and recreation for working men and women, and Dickens had agreed to make a speech in order to raise money for such a good cause. The themes of his speech were the need for education and that ignorance was the parent of misery and crime. These themes no doubt dominated his thoughts on the journey north, and ignorance and want, in A Christmas Carol, are presented to Scrooge as two starved, neglected children by the ghost of Christmas present. The writing of A Christmas Carol gripped him, taking less than 2 months to complete. Dickens was writing Martin Chuzzlewit at the same time, and both share the theme of selfishness and benevolence. In the story of Scrooge and his conversion from avarice to generosity, Dickens emphasizes the importance of family love and the delights of home, which became the recurring theme in all his Christmas books. He also creates a mood of nostalgia for lost values and the necessity of linking Christmas joy to charitable acts. Dickens had associated himself with Christmas from the very start of his career. One of the early sketches by Boz is entitled A Christmas Dinner. His daughters in their memoirs seem to imply that their father lived up to his image as the spirit of Christmas at home, though Kate Dickens, in a letter to Bernard Shaw, many years after her father's death, remarked that there had been more to him than this popular public image might suggest. "If you could make the public understand that my father was not a joyous, jocose gentleman walking about the world with a plum pudding and a bowl of punch, you would greatly oblige me." Dickens saw Christmas as a family occasion, surely, but there must have been times when he felt less of the Christmas spirit as he contemplated his growing family and the financial responsibilities they incurred for him, the breadwinner. By 1843, apart from his wife Catherine and her sister Georgina, who lived with them as housekeeper, he had 4 children, as well as his brothers and indigent father, to maintain. A Christmas Carol was written partly in response to the demands of this large family, and Dickens spoke bluntly of the profits he hoped to accrue from it. Unfortunately, although it was an instant success, his profits on the colossal sales of A Christmas Carol were severely curtailed because of the high quality of production he insisted upon. The novel sold 6,000 copies on the first day of publication, and has never been out of the bestseller list since. Dickens received scores of letters from people from all walks of life, testifying to the comfort and benefits his little book had brought to them. How it was read aloud in the house and given a special place of its own on the shelf. As the profits began to trickle in, he was able to acknowledge it was a most prodigious success, the greatest I think I have ever achieved. Why has this novel of Dickens's been such a phenomenal success with the public, to the extent that it has virtually achieved the status of a myth? Well, perhaps it's because A Christmas Carol taps into a universal wish that what is bad in mankind will be made good by self-knowledge or, if necessary, by a supernatural force. Dickens uses the supernatural as an agency to make things happen. He doesn't feel the need to explain its use. For Dickens, it needs no explanation. And he prepares the reader for the events on the night before Christmas by implying that all inanimate objects potentially have a life, such as the door knocker that turns into the face of Marley, Scrooge's dead partner. At the centre of the story, there is also this magnetic character, Scrooge. Scrooge represents unfeeling authority. Elsewhere in Dickens, it is variously symbolised as the state, the law, or the parish workhouse. And how this fixed position cuts him off and separates him from feeling personal sympathy. But Dickens makes Scrooge both despicable and lovable at the same time. We feel there is a better man beneath the old curmudgeon, that he was not born avaricious, and so his nature can therefore perhaps be reversed. The Christmas ghosts show him his past, once full of prospects, but destroyed by his love of money. The present, how the world, despite his cynical view of the season, bar humbug, abounds in simple affection, such as the Cratchit family show to each other. And his future, a mean death, despised by all who knew him. Scrooge is humbled, but in the true tradition of a fairy tale, where anything can happen, he is saved to mend his ways and bring joy, not misery, to the world about him. Everything coming right just in time for Christmas Day is one of the most satisfying aspects of this story, whose regenerative power we feel every time we read it. Though we may not all identify with Scrooge, we are able to examine his character in the light of our own. The selfish can be less so, the generous more so. The good-natured extend their influence further, and so on. It is a myth for all time. Dickens's friend Thackeray summed up its effect for his own time. It seems to me a national benefit, and to every man or woman who reads it, a personal kindness. Scrooge and his nephew.
Once upon a time, of all the good days in the year, on Christmas Eve, old Scrooge sat busy in his counting house. It was cold, bleak, biting weather, foggy withal, and he could hear the people in the court outside go wheezing up and down, beating their hands upon their breasts and stamping their feet upon the pavement stones to warm them. The city clocks had only just gone three, but it was quite dark already. It had not been light all day, and candles were flaring in the windows of the neighbouring offices like ruddy smears upon the palpable brown air. The fog came pouring in at every chink and keyhole, and was so dense without that although the court was of the narrowest, the houses opposite were mere phantoms. To see the dingy cloud come drooping down, obscuring everything, one might have thought that nature lived hard by and was brewing on a large scale. The door of Scrooge's counting-house was open, that he might keep his eye upon his clerk, who in a dismal little cell beyond, a sort of tank, was copying letters. Scrooge had a very small fire, but the clerk's fire was so very much smaller that it looked like one coal. But he couldn't replenish it, for Scrooge kept the coal-box in his own room, and so surely as the clerk came in with the shovel, the master predicted that it would be necessary for them to part. Wherefore the clerk put on his white comforter and tried to warm himself at the candle, in which effort, not being a man of a strong imagination, he failed. "A Merry Christmas, Uncle! God save you!" cried a cheerful voice. It was the voice of Scrooge's nephew, who came upon him so quickly that this was the first intimation he had of his approach. "Bah!" said Scrooge. "Humbug!" He had so heated himself with rapid walking in the fog and frost, this nephew of Scrooge's, that he was all in a glow. His face was ruddy and handsome, his eyes sparkled, and his breath smoked again. "Christmas a humbug, Uncle," said Scrooge's nephew. "You don't mean that, I'm sure."
"I do," said Scrooge. "Merry Christmas! What right have you to be merry? What reason have you to be merry? You're poor enough."
"Come then," returned the nephew gaily. "What right have you to be dismal? What reason have you to be morose? You're rich enough." Scrooge, having no better answer ready on the spur of the moment, said, "Bah!" again, and followed it up with, "Humbug!"
"Don't be cross, Uncle," said the nephew.
"What else can I be?" returned the uncle. "When I live in such a world of fools as this, Merry Christmas! Out upon Merry Christmas! What's Christmas time to you but a time for paying bills without money? A time for finding yourself a year older but not an hour richer? A time for balancing your books and having every item in 'em through a round dozen of months presented dead against you? If I could work my will," said Scrooge indignantly, "every idiot who goes about with Merry Christmas on his lips should be boiled with his own pudding and buried with a stake of holly through his heart. He should."
"Uncle," pleaded the nephew.
"Nephew," returned the uncle sternly, "keep Christmas in your own way and let me keep it in mine."
"Keep it?" repeated Scrooge's nephew.
"But you don't keep it." "Let me leave it alone, then," said Scrooge. "Much good may it do you, much good it has ever done you."
"There are many things from which I might have derived good, by which I have not profited, I dare say," returned the nephew.
Christmas among the rest. But I'm sure I have always thought of Christmas time, when it has come round, apart from the veneration due to its sacred name and origin, if anything belonging to it can be apart from that, as a good time, a kind, forgiving, charitable, pleasant time. The only time I know of in the long calendar of the year when men and women seem by one consent to open their shut-up hearts freely, and to think of people below them as if they really were fellow passengers to the grave and not another race of creatures bound on other journeys. And therefore, Uncle, though it has never put a scrap of gold or silver in my pocket, I believe that it has done me good and will do me good, and I say, God bless it. The clerk in the tank involuntarily applauded. Becoming immediately sensible of the impropriety, he poked the fire and extinguished the last frail spark for ever.
"Let me hear another sound from you," said Scrooge, "and you'll keep your Christmas by losing your situation."
Fezziwig's Party.
"Yoo-hoo, my boys," said Fezziwig. "No more work tonight. Christmas Eve, Dick. Christmas, Ebenezer. Let's have the shutters up," cried old Fezziwig with a sharp clap of his hands, "before a man can say Jack Robinson."
You wouldn't believe how those two fellows went at it. They charged into the street with the shutters, 1, 2, 3, had them up in their places, 4, 5, 6, barred them and pinned them, 7, 8, 9, and came back before you could have got to 12, panting like racehorses.
"Hilly-ho!"
cried old Fezziwig, skipping down from the high desk with wonderful agility.
"Clear away, my lads. Let's have lots of room here. Hilly-ho, Dick. Chirrup, Ebenezer!"
Clear away? There was nothing they wouldn't have cleared away, or couldn't have cleared away, with old Fezziwig looking on. It was done in a minute. Every movable was packed off, as if it were dismissed from public life for evermore. The floor was swept and watered, the lamps were trimmed, fuel was heaped upon the fire, and the warehouse was as snug and warm and dry and bright a ballroom as you would desire to see upon a winter's night. In came a fiddler with a music-book, and went up to the lofty desk and made an orchestra of it, and tuned like 50 stomach-aches. In came Mrs. Fezziwig, one vast, substantial smile. In came the 3 Miss Fezziwigs, beaming and lovable. In came the 6 young followers whose hearts they broke. In came all the young men and women employed in the business. In came the housemaid with her cousin the baker. In came the cook with her brother's particular friend the milkman. In came the boy from over the way, who was suspected of not having board enough from his master, trying to hide himself behind the girl from next door but one, who was proved to have had her ears pulled by her mistress. In they all came, one after another, some shyly, some boldly, some gracefully, some awkwardly, some pushing, some pulling. In they all came, anyhow and everyhow. Away they all went, 20 couple at once, hands half round and back again the other way, down the middle and up again, round and round in various stages of affectionate grouping, old top couples always turning up in the wrong place, new top couples starting off again as soon as they got there, all top couples at last, and not a bottom one to help them. When this result was brought about, old Fezziwig, clapping his hands to stop the dance, cried out, "Well done!" And the fiddler plunged his hot face into a pot of porter, especially provided for that purpose. But scorning rest, upon his reappearance he instantly began again, though there were no dancers yet, as if the other fiddler had been carried home exhausted on a shutter, and he were a brand-new man resolved to beat him out of sight or perish. There were more dances, and there were forfeits, and more dances, and there was cake, and there was negus, and there was a great piece of cold roast, and there was a great piece of cold boiled, and there were mince pies and plenty of beer. But the great effect of the evening came after the roast and boiled, when the fiddler, an artful dog, mind, the sort of man who knew his business better than you or I could have told it him, struck up Sir Roger de Coverley. Then old Fezziwig stood out to dance with Mrs. Fezziwig. Top couple, too, with a good stiff piece of work cut out for them. 3 or 4 and 20 pair of partners, people who are not to be trifled with. People who would dance and had no notion of walking. But if they had been twice as many, 4 times,
Old Fezziwig would have been a match for them, and so would Mrs. Fezziwig. As to her, she was worthy to be his partner in every sense of the term. If that's not high praise, tell me higher, and I'll use it. A positive light appeared to issue from Fezziwig's calves. They shone in every part of the dance like moons. You couldn't have predicted at any given time what would have become of them next. And when old Fezziwig and Mrs. Fezziwig had gone through all the dance, advance and retire, both hands to your partner, bow and curtsy, corkscrew, thread the needle, and back again to your place, Fezziwig cut so deftly that he appeared to wink with his legs and came upon his feet again without a stagger. When the clock struck 11, this domestic ball broke up. Mr. and Mrs. Fezziwig took their stations, one on either side of the door, and shaking hands with every person individually as he or she went out, wished him or her a Merry Christmas. When everybody had retired but the two prentices, they did the same to them, and thus the cheerful voices died away and the lads were left to their beds, which were under a counter in the back shop.
The Ghost of Christmas Present.
The moment Scrooge's hand was on the lock, a strange voice called him by his name and bade him enter. He obeyed. It was his own room. There was no doubt about that. But it had undergone a surprising transformation. The walls and ceiling were so hung with living green that it looked a perfect grove, from every part of which bright gleaming berries glistened. The crisp leaves of holly, mistletoe and ivy reflected back the light as if so many little mirrors had been scattered there. And such a mighty blaze went roaring up the chimney as that dull petrification of a hearth had never known in Scrooge's time, or Marley's, or for many and many a winter season gone. Heaped up on the floor, to form a kind of throne, were turkeys, geese, game, poultry, brawn, great joints of meat, sucking pigs, long wreaths of sausages, mince pies, plum puddings, barrels of oysters, red-hot chestnuts, cherry-cheeked apples, juicy oranges, luscious pears, immense twelfth cakes, and seething bowls of punch that made the chamber dim with their delicious steam. In easy state upon this couch, there sat a jolly giant, glorious to see, who bore a glowing torch in shape not unlike Plenty's horn, and held it up, high up, to shed its light on Scrooge as he came peeping round the door.
"Come in," exclaimed the ghost. "Come in and know me better, man."
Scrooge entered timidly and hung his head before this spirit. He was not the dogged Scrooge he had been, and though the spirit's eyes were clear and kind, he did not like to meet them.
"I am the Ghost of Christmas Present," said the spirit. "Look upon me."
Scrooge reverently did so. It was clothed in one simple green robe or mantle, bordered with white fur. This garment hung so loosely on the figure that its capacious breast was bare, as if disdaining to be warded or concealed by any artifice. Its feet, observable beneath the ample folds of the garment, were also bare, and on its head it wore no other covering than a holly wreath, set here and there with shining icicles. Its dark brown curls were long and free, free as its genial face, its sparkling eye, its open hand, its cheery voice, its unconstrained demeanour, and its joyful air. Girded round its middle was an antique scabbard, but no sword was in it, and the ancient sheath was eaten up with rust.
"You have never seen the like of me before," exclaimed the spirit.
"Never,"
Scrooge made answer to it.
"Have never walked forth with the younger members of my family, meaning, for I am very young, my elder brothers born in these later years," pursued the phantom.
"I don't think I have," said Scrooge. "I'm afraid I have not. Have you had many brothers, spirit?"
"More than 1,800,
said the ghost.
A tremendous family to provide for, muttered Scrooge.
The ghost of Christmas Present rose.
Spirit, said Scrooge submissively, conduct me where you will. I went forth last night on compulsion, and I learnt a lesson which is working now. Tonight, if you have aught to teach me, let me profit by it.
Touch my robe.
Scrooge did as he was told, and held it fast.
The Cratchit's Christmas.
Such a bustle ensued that you might have thought a goose the rarest of all birds, a feathered phenomenon, to which a black swan was a matter of course, and in truth it was something very like it in that house. Mrs. Cratchit made the gravy, ready beforehand in a little saucepan, hissing hot. Master Peter mashed the potatoes with incredible vigour. Miss Belinda sweetened up the apple sauce. Martha dusted the hot plates. Bob took Tiny Tim beside him in a tiny corner at the table. The two young Cratchits set chairs for everybody, not forgetting themselves, and mounting guard upon their posts, crammed spoons into their mouths, lest they should shriek for goose before their turn came to be helped. At last, the dishes were set on, and grace was said. It was succeeded by a breathless pause, as Mrs. Cratchit, looking slowly all along the carving knife, prepared to plunge it in the breast. But when she did, and when the long-expected gush of stuffing issued forth, one murmur of delight arose all round the board, and even Tiny Tim, excited by the two young Cratchits, beat on the table with the handle of his knife, and feebly cried, "Hurrah!" There never was such a goose. Bob said he didn't believe there ever was such a goose cooked. Its tenderness and flavour, size and cheapness, were the themes of universal admiration. Eked out by applesauce and mashed potatoes, it was a sufficient dinner for the whole family. Indeed, as Mrs. Cratchit said, with great delight, surveying one small atom of a bone upon the dish, they hadn't ate it all at last. Yet everyone had had enough, and the youngest Cratchits in particular were steeped in sage and onion to the eyebrows. But now, the plates being changed by Miss Belinda, Mrs. Cratchit left the room alone, too nervous to bear witnesses, to take the pudding up and bring it in. Suppose it should not be done enough? Suppose it should break in turning out? Suppose somebody should have got over the wall of the back yard and stolen it while they were merry with the goose, a supposition at which the two young Cratchits became livid. All sorts of horrors were supposed. Hello! A great deal of steam. The pudding was out of the copper. A smell like a washing day, that was the cloth. A smell like an eating house and a pastry cook's next door to each other, with a laundress's next door to that, that was the pudding. In half a minute, Mrs. Cratchit entered, flushed but smiling proudly, with the pudding, like a speckled cannonball, so hard and firm, blazing in half of half a quartern of ignited brandy and bedight with Christmas holly stuck into the top. Oh, a wonderful pudding! Bob Cratchit said, and calmly too, that he regarded it as the greatest success achieved by Mrs. Cratchit since their marriage. Mrs. Cratchit said that now the weight was off her mind, she would confess she had had her doubts about the quantity of flour. Everybody had something to say about it, but nobody said or thought it was at all a small pudding for a large family. It would have been flat heresy to do so. Any Cratchit would have blushed to hint at such a thing. At last the dinner was all done, the cloth was cleared, the hearth swept, and the fire made up. The compound in the jug being tasted, and considered perfect, apples and oranges were put upon the table, and a shovelful of chestnuts on the fire. Then all the Cratchit family drew round the hearth, in what Bob Cratchit called a circle, meaning half a one, and at Bob Cratchit's elbow stood the family display of glass, two tumblers, and a custard cup without a handle. These held the hot stuff from the jug, however, as well as golden goblets would have done, and Bob served it out with beaming looks while the chestnuts on the fire sputtered and cracked noisily. Then Bob proposed.
"A Merry Christmas to us all, my dears. God bless us,"
which all the family re-echoed.
"God bless us, everyone,"
said Tiny Tim, the last of all.
Want and ignorance.
"My life upon this globe is very brief," replied the ghost. "It ends tonight."
"Tonight?" cried Scrooge.
"Tonight at midnight. Hark! The time is drawing near."
The chimes were ringing the 11:15 at that moment.
"Forgive me if I'm not justified in what I ask," said Scrooge, looking intently at the spirit's robe. "But I see something strange and not belonging to yourself protruding from your skirt. Is it a foot or a claw?"
"It might be a claw, for the flesh there is upon it," was the spirit's sorrowful reply. "Look here."
From the foldings of its robe, it brought two children. Wretched, abject, frightful, hideous, miserable. They knelt down at its feet and clung upon the outside of its garment.
"Oh, man, look here. Look, look, down here," exclaimed the ghost.
They were a boy and a girl, yellow, meagre, ragged, scowling, wolfish, but prostrate too in their humility. Where graceful youth should have filled their features out and touched them with its freshest tints, a stale and shrivelled hand, like that of age, had pinched and twisted them and pulled them into shreds. Where angels might have sat enthroned, devils lurked and glared out, menacing.
No change, no degradation, no perversion of humanity in any grade through all the mysteries of wonderful creation, as monsters half so horrible and dread.
Scrooge started back, appalled. Having them shown to him in this way, he tried to say they were fine children, but the words choked themselves rather than be parties to a lie of such enormous magnitude.
"Spirit, are they yours?"
Scrooge could say no more.
"They are man's,"
said the spirit, looking down upon them.
"And they cling to me, appealing from their fathers. This boy is ignorance. This girl is want. Beware them both, and all of their degree, but most of all beware this boy, for on his brow I see that written which is doom, unless the writing be erased."
"Deny it," cried the spirit, stretching out its hand towards the city. "Slander those who tell it ye. Admit it for your factious purposes, and make it worse. And abide the end."
"Have they no refuge or resource?" cried Scrooge. "Are there no prisons?" said the spirit, turning on him for the last time with his own words. "Are there no workhouses?"
The bell struck 12.
These extracts have been taken from the unabridged recording of A Christmas Carol, read by Anton Lesser for Naxos Audiobooks.